Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to New Scientist Weekly, your curated selection of the week's science stories. I'm Christy Taylor in New York.
And I'm Timothy Revel in London. This week on the podcast, we celebrate the world's largest computer based on the human brain, a musician who found tinnitus both disabling and inspiring, and we recreate the songs birds have dreams about.
But first, in the 2015 Paris Climate Accords, countries set a goal of avoiding an increase in global temperatures above 1.5 degrees Celsius in order to also avoid the most catastrophic scenarios predicted in climate models. But a new analysis out this week suggests that geologic carbon storage, one of the key technologies we were relying on to hit this goal, may be less effective than previously assumed. Madeline Cuff is here. First off, welcome back, Maddie.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
All right, so what's going on with carbon storage?
So we already knew that the pathway to limiting warming to 1.5 degrees, that central Paris goal, was a really narrow one. Basically, we've released so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it's probably impossible to meet this goal simply by halting emissions. Instead, what most climate models assume is that we will have to actively remove some CO2 from the atmosphere in various ways and basically find somewhere else to put it. But new analysis that I've been covering this week suggests that we are wildly overestimating the amount of carbon we will be able to store by mid-century.
Tell me more about these estimates. Where did they come from in the first place?
So firstly, I'll explain a little bit about how these climate models work. They're known as integrated assessment models, or IAMs, and they are essentially used to set out potential pathways for global decarbonisation. So they model the balance of emission cuts and carbon sinks that we will need to hit our climate goals. So IAMs, you can think of them as blueprints for how the world could decarbonise. So it's vital that they're as realistic as possible. But the problem is, IAMs seem to have massively overestimated one carbon storage method, known as geological storage. And this is where we capture carbon dioxide, for example, by taking it out of the air and store it underground in depleted oil and gas reservoirs.
And so this is the one that they've overestimated. How much of this carbon storage do we need, do we want?
That's a really good question. There are hundreds of IAM models for the 1.5 degree and also a 2 degrees temperature target. So as you'd expect, with all these different model runs, there's a huge spread of potential results. But on average, the modelling results for a 1.5 degree temperature goal suggest that we should be storing around 9 gigatons of CO2 a year underground by 2050. That's a massive 1,000-fold increase on today's levels.
Whoa.
And some of the models go even further, requiring double or even triple this expansion.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot. That sounds very ambitious indeed.
Yeah, wildly unrealistic is another way of thinking about it. So researchers at Imperial College London in the UK have done the calculations, and they're using a new approach that better assesses how fast we could scale up geological storage over the coming decades. And they reckon that 16 gigatons a year of storage is the absolute maximum that is feasible by 2050. But that's unrealistic because it requires huge growth sustained over decades in pretty much every region of the world. And it also requires the US to deliver 60% of the total annual storage. That's 10 gigatons a year of storage in the US alone by 2050. And that's way beyond the 1 gigaton of storage that the US has promised by that date. So the researchers think a more reasonable, ambitious target is about 6 gigatons a year. And even that requires an annual growth rate in all regions, well above what we've seen from the sector in the last 20 years. So it's still an ambitious goal, but it's at least one we have a chance of hitting. Hmm. It's important to say this research hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but it does suggest that our ability to store carbon underground is lower than most models are expecting for our 1.5 degree temperature goal.
Why were these models so optimistic? It's not like we normally think of climate research as particularly optimistic. So why is the reality perhaps different from what had been predicted before?
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on here. IAMs are taking public information on a huge range of technologies. They model everything from the rollout of electric cars to what happens to coal power plants. So they're working with a huge mass of data, and where they can struggle is accounting for challenges in scaling specific industries. So, for example, a lot of the model runs expect huge growth in geological storage in parts of Asia, for example, where demand for this type of storage is expected to be really high if you think about where a lot of our energy and manufacturing is happening. But in Asia, the industry is incredibly nascent, so actually it's quite unrealistic to expect a massive and sudden scale up of the sector. And also the other thing that we need to think about is that the practicalities of geological storage need to be better accounted for. So at the moment, IAMs assume that you can just keep filling voids underground at the same rate. The reality of filling up a reservoir is a bit like filling up a cup. You can pour at a fast rate for quite a long time, but as you approach the top of the cup, or the top of the reservoir in this case, you have to slow down. So it's not just about the volume of storage that we've got available, it's about how quickly we can use it.
What does this mean for our climate goals? You know, are we locked in for more than 1.5 degrees of warming and therefore worse consequences?
Yeah, so if we kind of take a step back from all of this, essentially, what this analysis is suggesting is that we might not have massive amounts of carbon storage to fall back on to hit our temperature goals. And so without that, we will need to work harder to reach net zero emissions. And that is likely to mean faster cuts to emissions in other sectors, for example, or finding other ways to store the carbon, such as giving over more land to plant trees. But we're already pushing the system to the limit to make 1.5 degrees even technically possible to hit. So the idea that we could cut emissions even faster will probably raise some eyebrows among scientists.
Up next, Intel has announced that they have constructed the world's biggest neuromorphic computer. And neuromorphic here means that the computer is modeled on the human brain and nervous system. Intel says its machine could someday run artificial intelligence that's smarter and more energy efficient, or even just optimize transportation routes and run better, faster versions of the things we already run on big computers. Funnily enough, none of those things are tasks that you'd really associate with the human brain, but luckily, technology reporter Matt Sparks is here to explain it. Hi, Matt.
Hi there, Tim.
So first off, can you just give us a quick neuromorphic computing 101? What exactly is a neuromorphic computer?
Sure. So neuromorphic computers are a different thing from the computers that you and I use to write podcast scripts on and that sort of thing. They use a completely different architecture, although you can build them on silicon chips, just like we do traditional computers. The essential idea is that it mimics the pathways of the human brain much more closely than neural networks like ChatGPT or Google Bard, but it's still a very simplistic model in the grand scheme of things. A neural network is a collection of layers of neurons where an input is fed in at one end, processed through all those neurons in really regimented steps until it creates an output. But a neuromorphic computer takes an input and it triggers only the relevant neurons in chains until an output is created. So it's much more akin to what's going on inside our brains.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I can see why more closely mimicking the human brain is a logical direction to go in if we want AI to get smarter, considering the human brain is generally quite smart. Is that why it's being researched overall?
Yeah, there is a hope that replicating the way neurons spike in our brains might yield some sort of advance in AI, but there are other reasons to be doing it as well. You can imagine that only firing the relevant neurons is going to cut down on the amount of computation that's going on, so you can do more with less and use a lot less energy as well. So that's one hope. And then you also have this idea that data and computation are all done in these neurons rather than in a classical computer where the data is held in memory in one place and it's constantly shuttled back and forth. And again, that could save a lot of energy, but it could also cut a big time-consuming bottleneck out of the chain of how a computer works.
All right, so this is like taking the advantages of neural networks, but putting it right into hardware, rather than, say, running an abstract software model of it on top of a more normal computer.
Yeah, exactly that. So if you think that a brain-like model of computation is the way to go, a neural network running on a neuromorphic computer is as seamless as you can get with current technology.
All right, got it. So tell us more about Intel's machine. How do you measure a neuromorphic computer? You know, give us some numbers that tell us how cool it is.
Well, the first thing to say about it, this computer Hailer points, is that it's only the size of a microwave oven. So it doesn't really take a lot to be the biggest neuromorphic computer in the world at the moment. You think about the biggest classical computers and they fill entire rooms, so this is pretty tiny. Hailer Point, it's got 1,152 custom chips, all designed and made by Intel, called LoEHe 2, and that gives it an overall network of 1.15 billion neurons and allows 380 trillion synaptic operations per second. Intel, they tell me that adding more chips at the moment, that's not really the hard bit. These chips are still prototypes. They're not super easy to make, but they could just keep chaining them together to make something much, much larger already.
I mean, those numbers do already sound quite large, but it does beg the question if they can make it bigger so easily. Why haven't they done so already?
I suppose for one thing, this is already the biggest in the world. So in a sense, the pressure's off at the moment. Secondly, this is all in the really early stages of development. And the big hurdle at the moment is actually the software, not the hardware. So it's very hard to represent problems in the right way and get them running on these machines. And if that's the case, then there isn't really a lot of point making the hardware bigger.
So you've already mentioned that this kind of computer could run faster and more efficiently in terms of energy. What does that let us do that we can't already do?
Well, AI is certainly one thing that makes perfect sense for these machines. The hardware and the software for neural networks, they'd be an ideal match for each other. So these could be like custom-made chips for running AI, really. They could do it faster with less power as well. So that's certainly one thing. It's also quite an attractive idea that you might one day be able to teach AI models as they go. So they can learn new information and skills and not need to be sort of retrained from scratch, which is the current situation. And again, that would save huge amounts of time and energy and money. But there is also this hope that you could represent all sorts of traditional computer science problems in ways that could run on these machines. So logistics companies could make delivery routes optimal, or insurance firms could maximize their profits, all the sorts of usual things that people do with great big computers.
I have to ask, could a neuromorphic computer recreate human intelligence a bit better, or even consciousness? It feels like if we're replicating the human brain a little closer, maybe that's where this could end up.
Yeah, there's certainly a school of thought that suggests that in order to take what we've got now, large language models, and get to AGI, you know, a truly smart model, all we have to do is keep looking for things that go on in the human brain and adding them to the models until we've run out of things and we've got AGI. So yeah, in a sense, there is a hope. But also, if you look at the limitations of current AI models, I think we've got an awfully long way to go before that's even a consideration.
Have you ever dreamed of destroying a black hole?
All the time, Tim.
Yeah, I thought you might. Or maybe something else you've been wondering about is you've got some eclipse FOMO and would love to somehow make it so there's always a total eclipse somewhere on Earth. I know I've certainly had that recently with everyone in New York seeing at least a partial eclipse. Or maybe you're a simple person and you just wish that the Milky Way had more arms. Well, Dead Planet Society has you covered.
That's right. Leia and Chelsea are back to their destructive antics, rearranging the universe with a new suite of cosmic tools. This week's episode was all about finding ways to kill black holes. No spoilers here, but I will say they did, in fact, find a way. That's already in your feed, with new episodes dropping every other Tuesday.
You're going to love it if you listen to that. It's really fantastic. And coming up on the next episode of Culture Lab, Sophie Bushwick talks to author Meredith Broussard about the stories we tell about artificial intelligence and why the technology's shortfalls merit a more cautious, nuanced approach to actually using it.
One of the things that people imagine about AI is that it's somehow going to deliver us from the essential problems of being human. And that's just not it.
That's coming Tuesday.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hear that? That is the sound of tinnitus, the persistent ringing in your ears that can result from damage to your ears' sound receptive cells, among other causes. If you already experience this phenomenon, I'm sure you're already very familiar with how disruptive it can be to your life. If you've never dealt with tinnitus, please keep taking care of your hearing. Lola De La Mata is an experimental musician, and she has experienced tinnitus so profound she was left unable to work for many months. She even had vertigo and difficulty walking. And her new album, Oceans on Azimuth, is an exploration of that experience with the world inside her own ears. She had the sound of her own tinnitus recorded, that's what you heard earlier, and she even crafted instruments like ear-shaped gongs to help her capture the experience of sound even better. I sat down to talk to her about it earlier this month. Here she is explaining what it felt like when her tinnitus first manifested.
At first, it was a mixture of silence and deafening, sort of voltage surges. I've always had this really, really high frequency that a lot of us who don't protect our hearing and go to gigs have. It's not a badge of honor, as I've kind of taught my parents. It is a sign of a lack of awareness, not to point and blame people for their, you know, their high sort of frequency tinnitus loss, but just it's more just like it's not part of our curriculum. Even as musicians, you're not told about it. And I was just in a restaurant and somebody plugged in a keyboard without turning the master fader off or checking that it was off. And it just completely blew me off my seat. And over the next few months, I was kind of struggling with vertigo and vision problems, and my walking wasn't aligning with, you know, everything was off. My balance was off, my vision was off. And I was struggling to kind of keep a consistent sort of balance in how I was taking in sound. I mean, it got to the point where it was so loud I couldn't do anything. I was told to stop playing music. I was told to stop making music.
How did you find yourself again in a space where you could work then? And what was that like?
I think the first thing was being sure that nothing, that it couldn't harm me any more than making peace with it, I think, the tinnitus, because it is quite disorienting physically, mentally, orally. And so I think it took a couple of years for my body to stabilize. I mean, I was quite unwell for almost 3 years, where even my speech was sometimes affected. And I came across Jim, who runs the Hudspeth Lab in New York. And the way that he wrote about the ear and the functioning of the ear was, it felt very creative and it felt very accessible. And so I just wrote to him, and I think 2 or 3 days later, he wrote back and said, "Oh, great, I found another odd human who's obsessed with the ear." And so they invited me to come and visit the lab and meet all the biophysicists. So I worked with Marianne Schofield, who's a double bassist. And we spent a day just kind of finding, resonating, hitting, slapping the whole instrument, kind of thinking about it as an organism and how can all of it sound? A little bit like how I've been thinking about the ear. I mean, I learned quite late that the ear had the capacity to produce its own sounds. And obviously, when you have tinnitus, or at least the way that I hear my tinnitus, it's accompanied with a lot of pressure, with a lot of, or at least a sensation of pressure, with this kind of like, it draws my attention to the macro of the ear, like the architecture of the ear. I'm very, very aware of, almost as if I can hear my nerve endings fire, which obviously is unlikely, but it's this kind of sensation. And it's also a filter. It's always there. It's between the inside of the inner body and I guess the outer body. And it's just like a membrane, I guess. It's there in a very, very loud and pronounced manner. And so we kind of were trying to find a similar way of kind of invigorating the double bass and pushing all of the materials. So really thinking about the metal and the wood and the chambers in it.
I'm just wondering then, because you had your tinnitus recorded, what was it like to hear that played back to you? And, you know, does it sound in the recording the way it feels and sounds in your ear/brain?
I guess what was difficult was that we tried to do it in semi-scientific means by having me in a soundproof room, my head right by a tiny anechoic chamber. And I guess there was some disbelief in the moment for all of us when we captured it. We tried playing with the pressure in my ear by having me move my jaw and kind of try popping my ears and to see if the pitch would move, and it did. So we knew that it was definitely my ear that was, you know, making these sounds. I mean, there's a lot of people who might know about this phenomena, but I didn't. And so I was marveling at it. And the scientists in the lab were going, no, there's no way that this is what you hear. There's absolutely no way. And so I was plugging my ears and I was singing the pitch back, and it was kind of incredible, but it matched. I guess the difference between the recording and what I hear, in the recording you can hear my breath because of where it sits, where the microphone sits in your ear canal.
What is your, I guess, hope or concept of how people then experience this album? What do you want them to feel? What do you want them to understand?
I feel like the way that I made this record was by trying to see the sound, access the sound, touch the sound. I mean, the whole record has this very macro, very close quality, almost as if you're inside the instrument, on the surface of the instrument. I'd like you to imagine like you're in the ear, roaming around, walking along the cochlea, sliding down the ear canal. You know, you can touch and swim through the fluids.
Amazing.
Why not? And I just hope it allows us to have more conversations around tinnitus, which is something which is unfortunately still very taboo, especially around the musicians community, even more so in very established orchestras. And also just thinking about oral diversity, how we all hear completely differently. Hopefully the record kind of brings that to our attention.
That was experimental musician Lola De La Mata talking about how her experience with tinnitus changed her view of the world. Her newest album is Oceans on Azimuth, and it comes out next month. Meanwhile, if you want to learn more about tinnitus and all kinds of fascinating new insights researchers have about how we hear and how we lose our hearing, we've got a story for you. Health reporter Claire Wilson wrote a feature for this week's magazine. We'll link it in the show notes.
It's time for Lifeform of the Week. And this week we're turning to some dreamers from the avian world called Great Kiskadees. Now these birds, they appear to dream about singing, which if that wasn't cute enough, it may now actually be possible to hear those songs. To tell us all about it, we've got Carmela Padovich Callahan. Hi Carmela.
Hello.
So let's just rewind this for a minute. What do we actually know about birds and dreaming? Like, are we sure they even do it? And how do we know what they dream about?
Right. So that's the hardest question right off the top. But as it turns out, there's quite a few years worth of research on exactly this question. So do birds dream? And if they do dream, why would they be dreaming? So far, researchers have figured out that when birds sleep, there are patterns of activity in their brain that do resemble brain activity that you'd see when the birds are singing. And they've also seen that sleeping birds' vocal muscles move as if they were singing while they're asleep. In 2018, actually, we ran a story in the magazine where a researcher told us that if you could somehow pass air to a sleeping bird while it's doing these involuntary, like, nighttime muscle replays, you would end up with a song. And the folks that I spoke to this week worked out how to do basically that just with a computer instead of pushing air to an actual bird.
That's quite a wild thing to imagine. So they recreated a song that a sleeping bird's muscles would have produced had the bird been awake. Is that right? A kind of dream song?
Yeah, pretty much. They developed sort of a physics model for how the Kiskadee's vocal apparatus works. So, you know, how pressurized air moves through the throat and what muscles have to contract, what sort of flappy muscles have to vibrate in the bird's sort of vocal apparatus. And it's a kind of model that you could develop for a musical instrument. So the physics of it and the biomechanics is quite solid. And then they use measurements from actual birds to work out what muscle activity corresponds to what sound. So they could use bird measurements as input into their model and then synthesize sounds that would come out or parts of the song that this Kiskadee was dreaming about.
I know computer models of things have all sorts of uses, but this still feels like the best way to do a physics model of the real world. So what did it sound like to listen in on the sleeping bird's brain?
Right. I mean, the researchers, I think, were surprised by how much it sounded like actual, like, waking bird song. They told me they expected it to be a lot more rough than what they ended up with. It's still a little bit off in frequency from what a real bird would do, but they were all sort of like, wow, can you believe that we actually recognized it? And here's one example of a song that they recreated in the study. So that trill that you hear is also a fascinating part of this study because the Kiskadees are known to make these trilling sounds when they are having a territorial dispute with another bird. So the researchers, you know, were trying to figure out why would the bird be sort of nighttime rehearsing that particular sound. And they looked at the video recording of the bird. And while the bird was sleeping, the feathers on its head stood up, which is also something that would happen if it was in an actual fight. So they're speculating that they may have actually recorded a bird that was having a nightmare about fighting for territory.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, and I watched the video of this and it's so striking. It just suddenly puffs up. That trill you played really does sound like real bird song, but I guess what I want to know here is this enough to claim that we know then that birds have dreams just like we do, for example?
I think that part of sort of do they dream just like we do is part of the question that this research is trying to answer. I spoke to a philosopher who told me that for him, the answer is both that birds dream and that they dream differently than we do. So he argued that animals have embodied dreams that don't require language, but they're dreams nevertheless. But then I also spoke to a different expert, someone who sort of has more of a point of view of a biologist, and they told me that whether they're dreams or not, these sort of nighttime replays of singing behavior could have a real purpose for helping the birds solidify their singing skills. Mm. So maybe they're not dreams per se in a sort of like romantic sense of the word, but there's something the bird has to do to be a bird, a singing bird. But to fully figure out what's at play here, everyone agreed that we need to listen in on the brains of way more sleeping birds, so different species.
All right, Christy, what else happened this week?
Well, personally, I'm really excited about the news that we found a surprisingly enormous black hole and within our own galaxy. And it is not only surprisingly large, but the largest of its kind.
Of its kind. Okay, that sounds like maybe it's not actually the largest we've ever found, but what does this mean?
Well, this gets back to the fact that there are two kinds of documented sizes of black hole. So there's the supermassive ones, which are hundreds of thousands or even millions or billions of times the mass of our sun. Those are way larger than the one I'm talking about, but this one's still cool because it is a stellar mass black hole, which these are formed from collapsed supernovae, and they're much smaller, usually around 5 to maybe 20 times the mass of the sun. But now, about 200 light years away from Earth, we have found one that's 33 solar masses. That is the largest yet. It's called Gaia BH3, named after the Gaia Space Telescope. And if 200 light years sounds close, it is. It is the second closest black hole to Earth, in fact.
That's very cool. Close and big at the same time. So do we know how it got to be as big as it is?
Right. Well, that's the question. But the research team has a theory that involves a star that's very close by this black hole. The star is made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium, which is actually weird because most stars contain at least some heavier elements. But this star could actually be from the very first generation of stars, which would have been very low in the heavy elements. Basically, all of this leads to a theory that the black hole might be so big because it formed from an ancient giant star, which was different in composition, so it grew and evolved differently from more modern stars, which get us smaller stellar black holes. And, lucky for us, gravitational wave detections from other galaxies suggest that there are more big stellar black holes out there of around the same size. So this could just be the beginning of a new understanding of stellar black holes.
All right, so that's the biggest stellar black hole. What about the news of the discovery of an extinct marine reptile that may have been the biggest ever to swim the oceans?
Call me Ishmael. Tell me more.
All right, Ishmael. In 2020, a group of amateur fossil hunters, including an 11-year-old girl, found a giant chunk of bone on a beach in the UK. And when researchers at the University of Manchester looked at it more closely, they realized that it was part of a jawbone from a much, much larger animal, an ichthyosaur, technically, which are those group of marine reptiles that ruled the oceans between about 250 and 90 million years ago. And this one in particular, well, it would have been the biggest we've ever seen, at up to 20 or perhaps even 25 meters long.
I have to ask, how do you take a small fragment of a jawbone and figure out the length of the entire animal?
Yeah, it's a bit of extrapolation, but luckily we've found other giant jawbones from slightly less giant ichthyosaurs in the past, and that can help researchers extrapolate to figure out the final size. Though, of course, we can't completely rule out the possibility that this animal just had a surprisingly giant chin. But from this new jawbone, as well as several other bones found at the same time, the researchers concluded the bones were from a completely new species that they've named Ichthyotitan severnensis, which is, of course, scientist for giant fish lizard of the River Severn.
Amazing.
These remains, they were about 202 million years old, which would put them as living right before a major global extinction event that wiped out many of the giant ichthyosaurs. And at least as far as the paleontological record suggests, that would make this new species the last of the giant ichthyosaurs. None really got anywhere close to as big as this after that.
All right, one last story. Researchers have found a surprising connection between skin wounds and gut problems.
So I guess those are two things that I wouldn't necessarily think would be related at all. So what's going on?
People with skin diseases like psoriasis, it's already known that they often also have gut conditions like food allergies and inflammatory bowel disease. They have different intestinal microbes than people with healthy skin. This we already knew, but the general assumption had been that gut is influencing the skin like it does so many other things. So like the food allergies might cause the psoriasis. But new research in mice has found evidence that actually that relationship could go in the other direction. If you give mice skin wounds, their gut microbes change. They have fewer beneficial microorganisms and more disease-causing bacteria. And these mice become more susceptible to colitis than unwounded mice. There's a very handy drug you can use to induce colitis, and the wounded mice had much more severe results. And the researchers also gave unwounded mice gut transplants from the wounded mice, and those mice also became more susceptible to colitis. And I really want to stress here that the researchers who did the work, even they said that this result was unexpected.
Do they know why it worked this way? And like, what's going on in the skin that would reach the gut microbiome? How could they be linked?
That's a great, important question. We don't know. But an unrelated researcher did suggest the team investigate cortisol. That's a hormone-related distress. He said it was possible that wounding the mice releases cortisol because, you know, being stabbed is stressful. And cortisol is known to affect the microbiome and raise the risk of gut infections. Either way, human clinical trials are the next step for this, according to the original researchers, and maybe we can design better therapeutics for skin disease that then would also have a benefit for our gut health.
That's it for this week. You can read all the stories we've talked about today in the show notes. And of course, there are many more like them on our website, which is newscientist.com. Plus, if you like the great stories we're bringing you, please give us a rating or review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Share your favorite stories or just tell your nerdy friends all about us. And we'll be back next week to tell you many more exciting things. So that's bye for now.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.